Good afternoon and welcome to today's live webinar, People, Process, and Technology, Redefining Your Publishing Value Chain, sponsored by SPI Global and powered by Book Business Magazine. I'm Matt Steinmetz, publisher and brand director of Book Business, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to today's event. Now, before we get started, let me take a second quickly to point to a couple of tips for attendees. You'll see there's a widget on your console. It should be blue. It should have a wrench on it. If you missed the tech tips video that we played leading up to the webinar, you can always click on this widget for more information. We also have technical help standing by, so if you have questions, please submit them. Also be aware that you can resize your viewing window at any time during today's program by dragging the bottom right corner of that window. Also, if you'd like to view this webinar again at a later date, or share it with your colleagues. It will be available for viewing on demand starting tomorrow at 2 p.m. So here today to share their perspectives with all of us are Nick Kemp, Global Head of MSS Production for Macmillan Science and Scholarly, as well as John Prabhu, Vice President, Solutions Architect at SPI Global. Nick and John will take us through the next 40 minutes or so, and we'll spend the final portion of today's event taking questions from our audience. Please note you can submit your questions at any point over the course of the next hour. We'll be logging them and tracking them as they come in, so please do send your questions in. The more the better. Nick Kemp is Global Head of MSS Production for Macmillan Science and Education and is based in New York. He leads the global production teams for the Science and Scholarly Journals Division, incorporating Nature Publishing Group, Palgrave Macmillan, and Scientific American Magazine. His responsibilities span the content production workflow from accept to publication online and in print, including copy editing, content enrichment, layout, author proofing, and web checking. Most recently, he has worked on projects to adopt XML-first workflows and to map, track, and measure changes to workflows to improve volume capacity and cycle times. Prior to his time in Macmillan in New York, Nick worked as production and IT director at The Lancet and at Macmillan in the UK, working in book publishing production and in the magazines division on a number of health and science titles that included Nursing Times and Nature. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome Nick to the call today. And at this point, I'll hand things over to him.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Hello, everybody. I'd like to start today by telling you a little bit about the background and history of our company, how our publishing program has evolved, and how the ownership has changed over the years. Then I'll describe how digital technology has presented challenges for us, but also opportunities from the huge growth in publishing volume. I'll describe how we have recently transformed our infrastructure to address these challenges, and lastly, describe our approach to process improvement initiatives. So the Macmillan Company was founded in 1843 by two brothers, Daniel and Alexander Macmillan from Scotland, and they began out publishing books. From the beginning, they had a strong interest in science and learning, and they created Nature, the weekly multidiscipline science journal, in 1869. Soon after that, the beginnings of what would one day become the Palgrave publishing brand began when they published Sir Robert Palgrave's three-volume Dictionary of Political Economy in 1894, 96, and 99. For over a century, Macmillan remained one of the oldest independent publishing houses until in 1995 they were bought by the privately owned German media group, George von Holtzbrinck Publishing. Now, the 1990s saw the number of submissions to Nature rise. Our rejection rate was high, which meant the waiting time to be published in the print journal was long, and we had no publishing options for the excellent papers we were rejecting from Nature. So to address this problem, the Nature brand was extended with the launch of new specialist research journals, starting with Nature Genetics in 1992. This has continued with the launch of 15 more, such as Nature Photonics, and most recently this year, Nature Plants. To accommodate this growth in a number of publications, Nature Publishing Group was created in 1999, merging Stockton Press, publisher of more specialist academic journals, such as Oncogene, with Macmillan Magazine's publisher of Nature and the new sister research titles. In October 2000, a whole new series of peer-reviewed journals, the Nature Reviews journals, were launched. These publish superbly illustrated, high-impact reviews written by leading international researchers. And we now have 15 review titles in the life sciences and clinical specialties, with another in the works called Nature Disease Primers, which is set to launch later this year. Up until this time, our publishing value chain was very traditional and print-focused. Our workflows were all geared towards publishing and distributing print copies for subscribers. We had multiple variations to our workflows and templates, geared mostly to the preferences of individual editors or geography. And by that I mean if the editorial and production teams were based in the UK, the US, or Asia. The growth in submissions continued, and to help manage this, we began using an electronic manuscript tracking system to enable authors and societies to upload electronic versions of manuscripts to us and to help track the progress of papers from submission through peer review and revision to acceptance. Adopting an easier electronic system to upload papers contributed to even more growth in the number of papers submitted. Then, in close cooperation with our typesetter, we also developed a tracking system to help manage and track the production workflow for journals that used external copy editing and composition resources. We also scanned our print archives and made them available on CD-ROM in 1995, and that same year Nature had its first presence on the World Wide Web with the launch of Nature.com. We started a daily news service called Nature Science Updates, which later became Nature News and Comment, combining news stories with additional reader comments. In 1997, we launched a press site, which allows reporters to download full-text PDFs of papers, multimedia, commentaries, and more detailed press releases from authors and their institutions for press release papers. And in 1998, we started for the first time selling subscriptions that offered both print and online access to full-text articles in Nature.com. Scientific American was acquired by the Holtzbrinck Group in 1986. It was originally founded in 1845, so it's even older than Nature, and it has the distinction of being the oldest continuously published magazine in the US. In a time of rapid innovation, Scientific American founded the first branch of the US Patent Office in 1850 to publish new patents and provide technical help and legal advice to inventors. It too has a sister title, Scientific American Mind, a bi-monthly science magazine concentrating on psychology and neuroscience, which was launched in 2004. These titles were eventually integrated with Nature Publishing Group in 2009. A few years ago, we also scanned the entire back archive of Scientific American back to 1845, which consisted of more than 5,000 issues, and we made it available to institutional subscribers. We produced full-text XML to improve search of the archive, and this incredibly rich archive has led to new digital products, which we've called the Scientific American Classics series, where we pull together content collections on particular themes, such as the Titanic, shown here, or innovations during a time of the Civil War, and we can sell them as special issues. Now, bringing together such well-established and recognizable brands as Nature and Scientific American helped Nature Publishing Group extend its market reach. The family of titles could now cover early career scientists and students, researchers, clinicians and doctors, industry leaders and senior managers, professors, librarians and educators, policymakers, opinion leaders, venture capitalists and investors. In addition to the established brands I've mentioned, as the company evolved, many new brands were emerging. Recognizing that there were many synergies across all the different companies and products, and that together we could be more than the sum of our parts, Macmillan Science and Education was created in 2012, bringing together Nature Publishing Group, Macmillan Education, Macmillan Higher Education, Palgrave, and our newest divisions, Digital Science, Digital Education, and Macmillan New Ventures. These three companies focused on emerging technologies, and they invested in and supported software development startups like ReadCube, for example, which allows researchers to access, manage, annotate, and share research papers in PDF format, or LabGuru, software to help research teams track and manage their work in labs. And on the education side, onestopenglish.com, an online resource for English language teachers, and Saplin Learning, which provides an interactive online homework environment. Companies like these. Taken all together, these companies now employ over 5,000 people in over 50 countries, and they stay true to the original mission of transforming learning and discovery. The 2000s saw the emergence of open access publishing, with a variety of models being tried. We launched the first Nature-branded title with an open access option in 2010 with Nature Communications. This was a hybrid open access title where articles were either available through a subscription or open access if the author chose to pay an open access publishing fee. This title eventually went fully open access last year, and meanwhile, in 2011, we launched another multidiscipline, fully open access title called Scientific Reports. This is a mega journal in that it publishes any article that is technically sound and not subject to the same acceptance criteria as other Nature journals. Our breadth of open research coverage was extended further last year when we launched the Nature Partner Journals, or NPJ journals. These are high-quality, open-access, online-only journals published in partnerships with institutions, foundations, and academic societies. And then lastly, in January of this year, we launched Palgrave Communications. This is an open-access, online-only journal dedicated to publishing high-quality, original research across all areas of the humanities, social sciences, and business. Now, alongside the growth in publishing volume, there were new digital content distribution channels opening up, like open databases. The example shown here is the Protocols Exchange, which we launched ourselves from one of our journals called Nature Protocols. This is an open resource where scientists can pull their protocols, which are presented in a recipe style, and they provide step-by-step descriptions of procedures which users can then take to the lab and immediately apply in their own research. The intention is that this helps accelerate additional research. Then there's also mobile apps which were developed to enable our journals to be read on iPhones and iPads. Our video publishing was expanding with a channel dedicated to our videos on YouTube. And the full Nature Archive was made available online back to 1869. To lead this growing area of product development, a Chief Product Office was formed in 2014, focusing on the new skill sets around user experience and design, customer insights, and data analytics for the better development of author and reader tools, and to develop new products on nature.com and palgrave.com. They have built a new publishing platform that enables new journals to be launched much more quickly than before. Setting up new journals used to take months, and now we can do it in days. More control for content and presentation online is now placed directly into the hands of our marketing and editorial staff without the need to have everything routed through our web production and development teams. The journals on the new platform have an improved user experience, and so do our mobile apps. And so far, we have approximately 12 journals on the new platform, with plans underway to migrate our existing titles and our archives over to the new platform soon. A new open research journal, Scientific Data, was developed by our product office and launched on a new platform last year. This is a new type of journal in that it allows researchers to publish their data sets to enable other researchers to discover and reuse their data. On our new platform, article citation metrics are made available. The overall altmetric score is a single number count for article citations from multiple citation service databases, Web of Science, Crossref, and Scopus. And these counts are updated daily once they become available. And once a citation count for an article is available, The list of articles citing it is accessible by clicking on the citation source. The article content itself is enriched with a subject taxonomy, and keywords are assigned to articles that link to a subject area on nature.com where they are explained and directly linked to other articles on the same subject in our archive of published content. Now, up until the launch of our new platform, we had been converting our content to publish on the web using two different proprietary XML DTDs, one for the Nature journals and another for the Society and Partner journals. Our new platform, however, was built to use an open standard DTD using JATS XML, even though our workflows and tools weren't all built or redeveloped yet to handle JATS from start to finish. We also needed to standardize the multiple presentation templates we were using for displaying HTML, our online PDFs, and our print PDFs, and reduce the number of variables we had in our workflows. For example, streamlining the number of vendors we used, eliminating the variables that occurred simply because of geography or because of individual preference. Our book publishing companies, meanwhile, were facing very similar challenges, and they also needed to move away from their proprietary DTDs towards more open standards to support publishing to HTML5 and EPUB formats. Now, an obstacle to achieving the kind of standardization we needed was that MS&E was composed of 32 different companies with scores of digital workflows. Over the years, we had created out of necessity numerous processes to address areas where there is little or no system integration. We also had multiple business systems that posed problems for integration and a smooth flow of metadata through the publishing process. For example, we used more than one production tracking system. We had no coherent approach for a publishing system or for a content management system, digital asset management, or rights management. So to address this, the company established a transformation office that coordinated a company-wide transformation for the three major publishing divisions, education, science and scholarly, and the emerging digital businesses. The technology teams that previously had been embedded with the businesses were pulled out and grouped together as a central resource to support the businesses and to better serve them and strengthen technical infrastructure and streamline our business systems and processes. Similarly, operations were centralized, bringing together finance, legal, human resources, and what we called global publishing operations, or GPO. And GPO comprises editorial production, print production, web and digital production, and brings these together with direct and indirect procurement functions. The goal of doing all of this was to better leverage systems investments, streamline processes, and get maximum benefit from the talent we had across the teams. Now, prior to this, we had already begun a digital-first program to radically change our digital workflows to make them more focused on the new digital product development and not be so print-centric. Up until this point, our workflows were geared towards creating content for conventional PDF page layouts, whether in print or online, which meant we were slowing the process down by focusing on page presentation before converting to XML and HTML for publishing online, and speed of publication was suffering as a result. When we started our Digital First program, we had many ambitious goals in mind. These were to enable us to scale rapidly and launch new products and significantly increase manuscript volumes even further, to save costs and do more with existing resources, to generate additional revenue, reduce manual intervention and duplication of effort in the processing of content, to provide an improved publishing service for our customers through greater speed and flexibility, to publish content as soon as it is ready, and to help our customers find and retrieve content more easily, to develop and maintain a flexible suite of standardized systems and processes, publish content to new and existing channels with minimal effort, and separate and recombine content components by tagging them at a granular level. The Digital First program, though, struggled for many years, and I wouldn't say it was because of mental resistance to change, because almost everyone recognized the need for change and supported it. It was just that there was a lack of agreement on what was needed and how the changes should be accomplished. I think, with hindsight, the company transformation needed to happen first to provide the framework we needed for implementing the changes. Collaboration needed to be improved, and establishing the centralized CTO, CPO, and COO offices helped. Each had a role to play. Technology to provide the necessary technical due diligence to every systems choice and investment, and to maintain oversight of the overall systems architecture. The product office to keep the needs of our customers paramount in all product development. And operations, the product office, and technology to all work closely together to plan the new end-to-end workflows and the systems that would support them. We've come to recognize now that our end-to-end publishing value chain starts with providing better tools to authors for manuscript authoring and submission, then moves on to peer review, approval, and acceptance. At acceptance, we create structured XML and move on to copy editing and enrichment prior to publication, and continues after we publish and distribute to any channel, online, mobile, and external databases, with tools to help our customers discover, assess, read, manage, and use our content. With more careful management of metadata, we could now break our digital content down into what we call research objects or building blocks, all the component parts that would make up a research article or a digital product. A typical article, for example, might be made up of the text, images, supplementary information including videos, and article metadata. By being digital first, we could have XML early in the process and enrich the XML by applying a subject taxonomy to assign keywords and facilitate better search and discovery, and then publish a content as soon as it is ready, either as a final author version in advance of copy editing and layout, or as a final version after copy editing and layout. Now, for a long while, copy editing posed a problem for the digital first workflow because it was still mostly done in an MS Word environment, which meant it was difficult, if not impossible, to convert to XML until after copy editing was completed. While some tools existed to tackle this, because of the need to proof authors and then make changes to the content, round tripping was required to first edit in Word, export to XML for layout, and then round trip back to Word to make changes and export to XML again, sometimes doing this multiple times. This did not work well, especially with large volumes of complex content. This situation changed only fairly recently as typesetting companies developed new copy editing tools that allow copy editing directly into the underlying XML and automated composition tools for producing layouts directly from the copy edited XML. They have also developed online author proofing tools that allow authors to make changes directly into their article proofs in an XML environment, preserving the structure of the XML throughout the workflow. With this in place, and partnering with the right vendors, we could truly say that we were digital first at last. This slide shows an online proofing tool, author proofing tool, from one of our typesetting vendors that we have been successfully trialing in a live environment on one of our society academic journals, Translational Psychiatry. To date, we have proofed over 150 authors using this tool and allowed them to make corrections directly into their articles. As you can see, it has a Word-like interface that allows them to see the red line changes that they make if they wish, and to generate a revised PDF layout of the corrected article on the fly. They can respond to copy editing queries directly into the sidebar on the left, and they can be required to answer each query before submitting their corrected proof. They can upload replacement figures, edit tables, and math and equations directly into MathML, as well as format, add, and reorder references. We have surveyed all the authors who have used this tool so far, and the results have been overwhelmingly positive. 80% said they prefer using a tool like this to annotating a conventional PDF proof, as it gives them more control and it reduces duplication of effort and the frequency of errors when someone else has to interpret their corrections and then rekey them. Our typesetting partners are also making great strides with automated page composition. We are doing this currently with two titles, Translational Psychiatry, which has a double column layout, and Scientific Data, which has a single column layout. The success or the pass rate is very high, particularly with the single column layouts, and the quality is good. And it forces us to standardize our templates, which is also a good thing, although there is still plenty of scope for branding, which is important for our society partners. We've also found it substantially reduces costs and improves cycle times. Before finishing, I do want to talk a little bit about process improvement, because in the last year, I really feel we have made a breakthrough in this area and have made some significant progress after some delays. When we discussed and began to map workflows for the first five journals that had launched onto our new publishing platform, we were alarmed to discover that each one had, to some degree or another, a different workflow to each of the others. It was either because of geography, whether the publishing and production teams were in the UK, the US, Japan, or China, or if they used a different typesetter, or if a society was involved that had particular design preferences. We realized to be able to scale more efficiently, we had to standardize the internal and external workflows more, as well as the templates and the systems that we used. So we began deploying a lean process improvement methodology, specifically the DMAC process, which stands for Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, and Control. This is a widely used data-driven framework for optimizing and simplifying business processes and is now being utilized in projects around our publishing platform and content production processes in London, New York, and Asia. We first began by organizing a workflow workshop, which was attended by production staff and run by a Lean Six Sigma professional. The attendees in the workshop looked at mapping our processes and our workflows, data collection, and carrying out together a root cause analysis of the various causes of delays or problems with our workflows that made them difficult to scale and to handle increased volume. Taking Scientific Data again as an example, this was one of the five new journals on our new publishing platform, and was an ideal candidate for introducing automated page composition and online proofing. We used process simulation software, which included tools for process mapping and workflow simulation functionality. And using this software, we first carefully mapped the Scientific Data end-to-end workflow, which is what's shown here on this slide. We then carried out a detailed data tracking exercise over a period of 3 months when we created spreadsheets to collect data from the various production staff and vendors involved in the workflow to time the various steps that they carried out when working on an article. Admittedly, for a time, this was a burden for them, but it was essential to gather the real data we needed. And along the way, it threw up some questions about the process map and how best to plot the workflow accurately. And there were some disagreements with the production staff, but that process alone was helpful for us to uncover inconsistencies and eliminate any confusion. Once we had the data, we could run it through the workflow simulation software and the process map we had created, and then it reported back to us on the overall cycle time. It reported on the wait time and the actual touch time in the workflow. So taking this one title, for example, it revealed that the average cycle time for a single article was an average of 30 days, of which approximately 28 days was wait time, and only 2.5 days was work time. And the actual touch time, excluding authors themselves correcting their proofs, was only 10 hours. So why does this help us? Because it starts to inform us where best to focus our efforts to reduce cycle time, and it shows us where the longest delays occur. Now, while we were conducting this exercise on Scientific Data, we had been meanwhile working with our vendor to introduce automated page composition. So with this process in place and using the process map we had created and the data we had collected, we were able to reliably measure the cycle time improvement from introducing automated page composition. And what this slide shows and what this process revealed to us was that the average cycle time from when we upload an article to the typesetter to when they send the page proof out to the author was 6.55 days before the introduction of automated page composition, and then it sharply fell to an average of 3.17 days after. So for the first time, we had a reliable method to measure workflow and process improvements. Now we plan to continue to use this method to improve and measure other workflow and process changes. One area in particular we will be focusing on is quality control, because in some cases, automation has already brought some benefits. For example, before transformation to HTML, for previewing web content, our JATS XML is run through a Schematron tool to check it is structured correctly and valid. If not, it is rejected and returned to the vendor for correction. However, apart from this one automated step, there are still numerous manual QC steps in the workflow. And because resources are limited, there are substantial wait times involved. We will be examining these and looking for ways to introduce more standardization and automation to improve these quality control tasks. So to conclude and sum up, we recognize the subscription and site license models we have been accustomed to in the past are changing with the growth in open access and open research. But while our margins may be decreasing, increased volume does bring new revenue opportunities if we can scale efficiently. To do that, we have to invest in new systems to better manage our digital assets and the rights associated with them. But that investment is then offset by cost reductions in our production processes if we can standardize and automate more. I do think the struggles we had implementing a digital-first strategy for MPG before our transformation efforts and the recent progress we have made after changes were put in place and the creation of MS&E illustrate that infrastructure is key. For us, we needed to pull technology out of the businesses and centralize it under a single CTO and do the same with operations under a single COO to streamline decision-making and set strategy and to keep an eye on the overall architecture of the systems and metadata. We had to identify the right partners who were developing tools that would work for us to improve our workflows, and we had to create a dedicated product office under a chief product officer to set the roadmap for developing new products, who through the use of data analytics, user testing, and market research would make sure we always keep our customers at the heart of what we do. Thank you. That's the end of my portion of the presentation, and I'll hand back over to Matt.
Nick, thank you so much. Wow, that's a lot of information to process in about 30, 35 minutes, and very impressed. Thank you very much for sharing it. Folks, for those of you following along, just another note that this presentation will be available to view again tomorrow, as I'm sure many of you are trying to take notes, as I am. Nick, before I move on to John, I just had a number of folks writing in with similar questions, basically asking generally what if you could identify what publishing platform you guys are using universally now.
This is an internally built and developed platform.
Okay.
So okay. We have our own developers who have built the platform.
Great. Well, don't go anywhere on us. We will come back to you with more questions in a bit, but for now I'd like to move on to John Prabhu. John has more than 21 years of experience in the publishing industry, developing solutions through all stages of the publishing life cycle. John's focus has been in developing a unified approach to content publishing and operational workflow strategies around ebook, XML production, semantic coding and enrichment, content engineering, publishing platforms, CMS and LMS, and customer back office support. As the VP Solutions Architect at SPI Global, John is focused on developing new services and products, implementing business models for next-gen publishing workflows, and with the goal of ensuring customer voice is integrated to the solution. So at this point, I'd like to turn things over to John and welcome him to the webinar.
Thanks so much, Matt. And thanks, everyone, for joining the webinar. Before I get started here, I just wanted to share very brief information about SPI. We have been in the market for 35 years, and we have been working with various set of clients, ranging from scholarly, STM, education publishing, trade, aggregated markets. So we see a wide range of data structure, data complexities, various levels of digital challenges. So in today's presentation, I'm going to share trying to see how some of the solutions would work across these multiple market segments. And there will be a lot of nuances, obviously, but we'll try to share some perspectives in different market segments. And as in my role that Matt just read about, my role is to make sure that we have a unified approach. So sometimes before even starting on a solution, we have to understand why we are even involved in this project. What are we trying to accomplish? Why this project? Who's the end user? What is the market that we're trying to address? And are we trying to extend the legacy data? Or are we going into a friend list of titles? So trying to get some perspectives and then connecting that with the user is an important step of our solution discovery phase and solutions architect. So I would like to share a very brief information about what's happening in the industry. Some of you may have read these kind of trend analysis report. Obviously, one of the big chunk is the millennials who are aged between 16 and 24, and what is the platform they're using. A lot of people who used to be in print mode or just accessing online in the web, reading a book in a PDF format, that's no longer the majority of the chunk. The biggest trend or the biggest growth market is on different levels of platforms. It is not just one web interface, but we're talking about mobile technologies and tablets and other users. So we have to understand where the customers are coming from and what type of platforms are they using. And I'm sure Apple is going to release their Apple Watch next month, in April. I'm sure those trends will change. And as you can see in this chart, there's already variables that's come into the picture and how the customers are going to use this technology, because technology is not just a disruptor, but it's interestingly, it's an enabling to monetize the content, to reach more users, to reach users globally. And I think understanding the technology and connecting to the users is an important step of our solutions architect. So here is a very good information about mobile, how it's growing. There's almost $3.3 trillion revenue in the global value chain that was seen last year. It was published by Boston Consulting Group. They work with various folks. And so when we say mobile, it is not just simply putting into an iOS and Android. It's a combination of whether it works in native app or whether it's an in-app sales or outside the app, and how the content is going to be structured and how the content is going to render across multiple platforms. As Nick was mentioning, moving away from the traditional print model into a digital model, digital does not, it is not just putting a PDF or not just rendering a content, a textbook, an online platform, but how do we make sure that we're providing an immersive experience to the learners, and but at the same time not losing the pedagogical value. And some of the key benefits, which I've just highlighted in red color in this particular chart, as you can see, it is not just monetizing of content, but also enabling the user experience to the next level, but also to create how we might be able to innovate ourselves continuously. Because whatever solution that we put in place, nobody can say that's going to run for the next 2-3 years. What we can do is making sure that the process and the solution has the flexibility. So any disruption, we're able to reuse the content, reuse the process. So this is the high-level value chain I just want to put forth. Obviously, it will differ from client to client. Depends upon what type of industry they're going to come from. But obviously, on the left-hand side, you're creating some content or you're reusing your content. On the right side, obviously, you're monetizing the content. And when I say I'm specifically using the term content, I'm not using pages, because content could be anything. It could be narrative content, like what you see in the e-textbook. It could be audios, videos. It could be any combination of it. So how do we use those chunk of content across the various stream of production process and editorial process, but at the same time, how does the content goes into multiple platform and distribution? That's the end-to-end value chain that we have to look into any of the solution. And as I said, we always need to step outside the box and think, rather keep on thinking the same way. It's just books and journals. Content could be anything. The recent ones that we are looking at with some of the few publishers is how can we use the social media content? There's a lot of blogs and articles being written about a particular type of book or a particular journal or a particular information that learners are interested. How can we use those user-generated content and articles that can be sitting on top of a book layer or a journal layer? So these are some of the things that we have to consider when we look at value chain or when we are reinventing ourselves. So here is the traditional workflow, obviously. Everyone started with print, that's been the market, and then people used a version of some kind of tagging structure, whether we call XML or something. Then people converted their XML into a certain DTD and then put it online. That's been the traditional print to digital. But what's happening, as we have seen in the market across the verticals, is how can we have content to be structured? It doesn't matter whether it's digital or print. We need to make sure content is looked at holistically and without tying into print restriction or digital restriction, but rather structure the content semantically and consistently and make sure that you're able to integrate interactive media. And there are a lot of multiple platforms. I mean, there's no one answer to it, but I'll share a few of the platforms that we have seen in the market and we have used in the market. But one of the biggest components that Nick also touched upon is how do we use this? We are seeing so much content, so what standard should we use? Obviously, people have moved away from proprietary to HTML to XML. HTML5 is a big buzz right now, and a lot of people have migrated into HTML5. Some of the clients that we have seen, they're using still a proprietary DTD, but on the fly dynamically converting XML into HTML5 for distribution. And we have seen certain clients who moved away from proprietary DTD, adopted into an HTML5 standard, for example, EPUB3 or EduPub, like that kind of a standard which has a semantic layer, which supports audio-video layer, which supports globalization language, not just English, but even Asian languages and Arabic languages, and also it has media overlays, and it supports right-to-left, left-to-right, it supports accessibility. So when you look at these new evolving standards like HTML5, so people wanted to move into that standard right away, so that there is a lot of redundancy. For example, people used to have XML, then have a transformation engine to convert into EPUB3, or have another transformation engine to convert to another output. So you have to maintain not only an XML tool, but also you have to maintain multiple other transformation tools. And I'm not saying this will be applicable across the market. You have to look at your client, your user market base, your type of content, what level of complexity involved, and sit back and think, do we really need XML, or do we need XML and some transformation to convert to HTML5, or can we move directly into HTML5 itself? So that's a level of conversation that is evolving across the stream. And as I said, there's a lot of platforms available. These are more from a front-end perspective, whether from an authoring or editing a platform or copywriting platforms. Some of these platforms are used across market segments in education and scholarly. Some of the platforms are very specific to technical reference material only. So, again, we have to look at your type of content and see what platforms might be used. One of the biggest things that is also evolving is these platforms are just from a front-end authoring, editing, but there is a back-end piece. The back-end could be either MarkLogic, could be Alfresco, could be Drupal, could be even a proprietary content management system, but as long the process flows are connected, as long the content is stored in one single repository, as long we're able to use metadata to search and retrieve, and whether the rights management is integrated within the platform, then the solution will be much more seamless. Because when I'm looking at a content, it's not just to produce a particular title today, but how can we reuse the content and how can I search at a granular level? So it's very important that the platforms, metadata system, rights management systems are integrated into a unified approach. And as I said, these are some of the standards that you've seen, whether your particular publishing model is towards ebook or towards e-learning aspect, or is primarily more on interactivity. There are multiple standards available, and you can basically integrate rather than having multiple different schemas or proprietary schemas. This is one example. Pearson has openly shared this across various industry consortiums. Pearson has adopted it into EduPub profile and HTML5. And because of that, they're able to do a digital-first workflow, and they are able to put it into their proprietary e-textbook platform or into an e-learning course model because of the ability to do digital-first and the standardization of HTML5. But the key piece also, if you look into content, when I say a lot of people have started with title or at a page level, but now we are looking at how can we take this content into more personalized, because personalized learning or people who are reading in a different devices is a key aspect. As you can see in this particular report, All these organizations are moving away from a page model or a book level model into a smaller chunk to enable adaptive learning, to enable personalization. And what's happening is when we say content needs to be chunk, it depends upon industry. This is an example where you have to look at content. What are the learning objectives in this chapter? A lot of times people will misuse the term learning objectives and tag it as bullet list. But semantically, it is a learning objective. In a technical reference material, people might tag a number list as number list, but the meaning actually could be a procedure or a step. So the goal is not only chunking at a small level, but are we tagging in appropriate contextual level so that I'm able to use any platform, I'm able to use any kind of style sheet to render in different ways. At the same time, I'm able to reuse the content for another document or to publish in another title. Here is an example, which is already available. I'm sure people are seen IMDb. When you look at a particular title, it gives a very small snapshot of it. And when you click a particular section, it goes into multiple levels of details, who are the actors, who are the director, and casting information. And when you click on a particular information, again, it pulls to different levels about the actors. Look at this kind of architecture from a content perspective, from a UX perspective, from a technology. It is all content. The content is chunked into smaller pieces. And it's directly metadata linked into it. So based on the user who's clicking on a video or an actor profile or a particular title, it's able to give you more details further upon. And then when you talk about, there'll be a lot of link which will be connecting to various third-party sites that is also available. That's a kind of a model. So I would say media industry has definitely gone far ahead and where we could learn some of the stuff that we could utilize into a market. Here is an example from Wiley. Wiley has one of the great products called Functional Chemistry. It's a journal that they publish in the web, but what they've done is also while the journal typesetting is going simultaneously, there is a content enrichment happens. There are a lot of SMEs involved who are looking at the content and see how can we take this content to more visual rendering, because learners, users like more visual, and that's very easy to grab the knowledge, learn the knowledge much faster rather reading just to the plain text. So that the platform is able to provide both a narrative content as well as visual content. So what's happening is each and every small compound level, there's a visual diagram and it forms a DNA at the end of the chapter or the end of the article itself, which means you can now search not only at a full narrative level at the article, but you can search just at the compound level and that can be reused in another product. So these are the benefits that you can see from content chunking. So just to enable personalization and able to store the data into multiple repositories and able to reuse the content and able to measure learning outcome because we cannot have a particular page tagged and we will not be able to understand whether the user was struggling to read a particular paragraph or a particular assessment or a particular topic without chunking the level of data. And that is possible, again, as I said before, how do we plan the architecture? The other biggest piece that people will have to consider is also the front-end portion of it, which is design. Obviously, here in this example, you can see a glass of water, how it will fit into, how it will not fit into different devices. And obviously, if you have a mobile-first strategy, and if you look at responsive design, and if you structure the content, if you structure the images so that it's able to read what type of device the learner is using, so the style sheet can automatically reuse a particular portion of the image, or if you can have a scalar SVG format that the image can render in the proper format. So those kind of content planning will have to go through into the content architecture and planning. So just to summarize on this aspect, a lot of times people will try to customize or hard code design into the ebook format or hardcode the technology for a particular device. Obviously, minimum viable product is a key, but we also need to make sure that the design is sitting separately and the content structure and metadata sitting separately and the technology and the platform sitting separately. They have to be integrated. They have to work together very closely, but the goal is not making sure that it's not hardcoded within the XML. Then there is if you take the same data, reuse it for another device, it's not going to work. So that's why architecture is a key, and also understanding the user base is going to be the key into this content planning. And this is another example. I just noticed that a couple of days before, by a company, Drafted Magazine. They're working with Blipper. It's a pretty interesting aspect. We talked about digital and technology, but augmented reality is another important aspect of it, because there are certain data like magazines or trade books or very highly illustrated, even educational or scholarly books. You have to retain that layout for any reason. It could be pedagogical reason. It could be the business value. But how can we use that same fixed, heavy illustrated design, but use that technology like augmented reality so that when you go to closer to that particular book material, it's able to recognize it and able to pin out to the minute level. In this example, you're able to pick out a particular watch and read through more data and additional data relating to the particular product in terms of pricing and discount. And finally, to touch upon is the skill set. As we have seen, the technology has evolved over many years. The publishing process has changed. The user behavior has changed. So it is not just putting to the tools and pulling the changing the process, but also making sure that how the team structure will change. And as you can see, the UX is going to be a critical factor. People with digital skill set working very closely with technology team and print team is going to be very important. And one of the information that we closely saw is what are the top skills that have been hired. As you can see, content creation, when we say content creation, it's not content creating for print, but it's generally content creation that can be used in multiple devices, and along with social media blog creating and article creation that can be used into your print product, that can be used as a separate layer on a particular product as well. Those are the kind of skill set that SPI is seeing, as well our customers are into it. And again, people must be familiar with the term STEM, scientific, technical, engineering, mathematics, and all. But what's happening is it's changing into called STEAM, which is basically including UX design and artistic feature as part of the content agile team itself. So when you look at publishing, you're not just looking at print people separately or digital people, but print, digital, design, technology, and metadata team, everyone is coming into it together to find out what will be the best process for that particular project or the particular program or particular series of titles. And here is a unified approach. Again, as I said, you have all these various levels of people who are involved in various steps, but how is your content management system is integrated between various systems? It doesn't need to be one system. It can be even multiple systems, but it has to be integrated through some API or using some open tools like learning tools interoperability that's published by MS Global, or using some of the metadata layer. But then back end, from a content perspective, it has to be at a granular level, so that we're able to reuse and repurpose. And finally, as I said, we're not just publishing pages, but we're publishing content, and which means we have to step back and look how can we revisit the content structure itself, and so that we are able to publish in different designs and for different products and for different distribution globally. That's it. Back to you, Matt.
Thanks, John. That was excellent. We have a lot of questions and not a ton of time to get to them, so I'm going to try to pick out a handful that seem to be coming in that were related. John, in terms of clients that you work with on an everyday basis, and particularly maybe some of the larger publishing organizations you work with, are you finding that most of them are now publishing, you know, basically digital first, or are they still sort of gradually beginning to publish digital from existing print workflows?
We are seeing both workflows. There is legacy of data that we have to bring it to the latest level of schema and structure and intelligence. So there is legacy. But the front list is definitely, we are seeing a huge amount of interest, people moving into a digital-first workflow, or we call simultaneous. Print is not going to move away. Print is still going to be there. But I think using the technology and using the various trends that we are seeing, publishers and all the organizations, I don't want to say just publishers, any content organization is moving into utilizing the digital-first workflow so that they can reach the market as quickly as possible, whereas waiting for print to release first. So we are seeing a huge amount of shift into digital-first workflow and simultaneous publishing.
You know, one of the things we did with this webinar this time around that we've not done in the past is we asked our registrants to submit challenges that their organizations are facing. And I tried we had several hundred registrants, and I tried to pick out seven or eight challenges that were mentioned by a number of attendees. I'm going to quickly tick through them, and then I've got one or two specific questions for you, Nick, and you, John, related to them. I kept seeing process improvement, keeping up with the speed of digital transformation, constantly changing workflows, overcoming mental resistance to those changes, the need to monetize the content we already own, chunking and chapterizing content and meaningfully adding metadata to it, and change management. And I think so much of, Nick, your presentation related to change management and to figuring out ways to integrate different and disparate technology teams across many different business units. And I think you spent several minutes toward the end of your presentation talking specifically about how you guys have done that. But if you could just quickly summarize that effort, A, how long it's taken? Has it been a couple of years? And any quick practical pieces of advice that you can give other publishers who are facing change management issues at their organizations?
Certainly, yeah. I think I touched on some of this, but I think to mention first of all the Digital First program, which we tried to undertake before we had done our transformation and changed the infrastructure, that ran for 4 years and had a lot of struggles because we didn't really have the correct infrastructure and structure of the departments in place. Since those changes were made, we've actually made a lot of progress very quickly. So I think actually getting that infrastructure right first, making sure you've got very streamlined and clear decision-making paths, if you like, is essential if you're going to actually affect a true business change. But once you have, I think the evidence we found is that then you can actually make the changes very quickly.
Right. John, anything to add to that?
I think it's trying to, Nick mentioned about Six Sigma methodologies. I think from a continuous process improvement, we look at in-process quality, and in-process, when I mean is from the start to finish, how do we map each and every sub-process, and how can we understand for each of the sub-process, what is the input, who is giving the input, and what is the output that sub-process is creating, and how can we measure that sub-process? Because quality can be said good, but what is good, we need to define it as statistically as possible, and if possible. And we try to bring in upfront validations into each of these sub-process so that we are not doing a final quality audit at the later stage, at the final delivery stage, or during the time when we're pushing to the end users. Rather, quality is measured and content validation is done throughout the process, starting from the upstream. And that's why when we talk about content planning, content structure, right from the authoring or editing interface is very important instead of the traditional methodology where people do only validation at the end of the phase. I think that gives a lot of escalation and governance because most of the time we tend to escalate issues at the final day of the due date. Rather, this change in the process helps us and helps the client to manage expectation, but at the same time resolve any challenges in the initial stage of the project rather than the late stage.
And then quickly, lastly, John, a number of people asking a similar question here. This person says one of our biggest challenges is getting all of our books ingested into all of the various ebook platforms. This takes us a ton of time. We're really curious as to how other publishing houses are increasing efficiencies in this area in terms of getting their books into various ebook platforms.
Sure. I mean, that's a good question. That is a global challenge across various customers. There's two approach that we have seen. It could be what I can call maybe correct or maybe it might be different from market to market. And it also depends on the content structure. If it's a plain digital content, I would say, we counted the number of devices in the market and we saw almost 120, 130 different sizes of digital devices with various screen sizes. So the answer is your content will not work across all the devices. I think it's very important to know what is your most majority of the customers who are using your product. It could be four or five. And start small, minimum viable product. That's the methodology. Start small, address the top priority customers who are using certain devices, let's say iOS and some portion of Android and certain screen sizes. And if you have like four or five categories initially, start with that and have a responsive design, because most of the time people use a fixed layout, and when you talk about fixed layout, then each and every product you have to create a separate product. For one device, you have to have another output, which means you'll have 5-10 different outputs. But if you have a reflowable with an HTML5 with a proper design sitting outside the code, then you're able to have a responsive design and able to test it in those 5 or 6 major platforms or devices and then release the product. That's what we have seen across the publisher. The second thing we have seen is some of the major publishers have their own platform itself. So they would have developed a web app or a native app so that they're able to control the user functionality, how they would like to render the audios or videos or images, a large table or financial diagram or a big geography like that. They're able to test it within their platform across 3 or 4 devices itself and able to control user experience in a small minimum manner. But again, the fundamental is structuring the data in a smaller chunk, the design, make sure it's a responsive design, and test it in, understand the user base, what your clients are coming from, what are the majority of the devices, and make sure that you have a fallback plan. For example, if you're using EPUB 3, there might be certain devices which may not support EPUB 3, which will support only EPUB 2. So you have to go into the OPF file and make sure that you have a fallback plan. So that's the way the content that we are seeing is being produced at the moment.
That's great, and I think it's a nice way to put a button on this. Gentlemen, an excellent job. I think 47 slides in 60 minutes is a record for us here at Book Business. So thank you very, very much, both of you, for your time. Nick Kemp of Macmillan Science and Society and John Prabhu of SPI Global. Thank you also to all of you who tuned in today. So again, on behalf of SPI Global and Book Business, thank you all for attending today's webinar. Have a great day.